Funding for Think comes from SMU Master and Doctor of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Jeff Whittington here in the studio today for Chris Boyd. Imagine yourself as a child with a limited education, forced to beg on the streets of foreign cities around the world, cut off from your parents, and with no idea of what the future might hold or how you'll ever escape. Then you start to imagine a different world. You start to write it down, and everything begins to change. In a nutshell, that's what happened to Taylor Stevens. Born into the Children of God, a group she calls an apocalyptic religious cult, Stevens was separated from her parents at the age of 12, and that's also when her formal education ended and she began nearly two decades of work, largely cooking and cleaning for hundreds of other members of the group. She escaped after becoming a mother herself and making the decision that her own kids would never be victimized the way she had. The character she created, Vanessa Michael Monroe, shares a few traits with the author: foreign experience, a missionary background, a strong sense of justice. And it's these traits combined with Monroe's skills as a problem solver, a learner of any language, an information gatherer, and when necessary, a highly trained and efficient killer that have won fans around the world. The latest book in the series is called The Mask. Taylor Stevens, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much.
So I want to start off and ask you, who is Vanessa Michael Monroe? Describe her to us.
I think the answer to that question changes on depending on who's doing the telling, because she's a chameleon. And I describe her as a bit of a predator. She's a hunter and a chameleon, obviously. And she just goes after whatever she needs to get a job done. So information is her specialty, because she has an ability to draw into cultures and put herself in a situation that most people can't, and she's quite capable of taking care of herself. But she's a bit of an enigma, so it's difficult to say exactly who she is.
Well, she's really intelligent. She's also really good with knives.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about her background.
Vanessa Michael Monroe, I call her Monroe. She was born to missionary parents in West Central Africa, Cameroon specifically, and she was an unexpected child. So her oldest sibling is 12 years older than her. So by the time she came around, her parents weren't really parenting anymore. So she was left on her own a lot. And rebelling from that, she went off on her own at a very young age, took up with gunrunners as an interpreter. And that was sort of the impetus that put her in a situation that created who she became.
And she's really good with languages. She can apparently pick languages up just a matter of weeks.
She's a linguistic savant. And so that skill with languages is sort of the underlying characteristic that has threaded through her life. Without that, everything else that followed would never have happened.
So you've written five novels featuring...
Five and a half.
And a novella. Yeah, five books and a novella. And I wonder if you feel like you always know what she's thinking, or does she still surprise you sometimes?
It's a surprise. And I think that's why the books are a little different. It follows her character arc as she grows and progresses, because just like we learn from our experiences and are changed by our experiences, so is she. So every time I go into a new book, the character really is changing and growing and progressing, even though there are core elements that will always be the same. So it's always a bit of a surprise and interesting to see where it goes in how she faces things.
One thing that I know you've been asked a lot is about creating a strong female character, and, you know, is it a feminist thing? Did you set out to do it? And the thing I'm really interested in is the fact that while she does push against convention in her methods and her skills, she pretends to be a man when it suits her. And I wonder, you know, how that character trait, how you decided to build that into her skill set.
Well, it actually came from real life, in the sense that I've lived in a lot of the third world, or actually, I guess that's not politically correct, the developing countries that she lives in, as works in. And, you know, we in more developed countries have made a lot of progress in the way that we view women and treat women, but we still have a long way to go in actually making it an egalitarian society. Mm-hmm. And these other countries, these developing countries, are so much further behind. And here we have a character who is seeking information, and that means having to deal with people, bribe people, track people, negotiate with them, and get herself into situations that, you know, might involve talking to government officials. It just goes on and on. And having lived in those countries, I knew it was impossible, absolutely impossible, that a woman who acts as a woman and dresses as a woman would ever be able to pull that off and be taken seriously, because there just aren't that many women in those positions. And so in order for this character to do what she does, the only realistic way to do it is for her to do it as a man.
Well, I felt like the title of the book, The Mask, is kind of the culmination of this character who does indeed, you know, walk around with this, you know, I see it as kind of a secret weapon that she has. She can always reveal herself or her true identity when and if necessary.
I like that. That's really good.
Well, I'm curious about the fact that you decided to set this book in Japan, and how you came to settle on Japan, because the other books have been, you know, you've been in East Africa, you've been in South America. There've been some books set here, right here in Dallas and in Houston. Some of the storylines have been set. Talk a little bit about Japan.
Well, as you mentioned, the stories have gone in many, many different directions. One characteristic or thing that shows up in each of these stories so far is that there's an international setting to them. So with every story that I'm telling, the setting plays a huge role in the plot, and the stories are written for the locations in which they're placed. So up until this fifth book of The Mask, we had been in North America and South America and Europe and in Africa, and I wanted to move further outside of that. And I had spent 5 years of my childhood, early teenage years, mm-hmm. In Japan. And Japan, and I left when I was 17, and I'd never gone back. And Japan was where some of the worst things had happened to me growing up. So Japan had always been there in the back of my mind of, you know, I wanted to go back one day. And when it was time to figure out where this fifth book was going to go, it all sort of culminated together where the timing was right, I needed a new location, and I was really itching to, I'd finally reached that place where I felt like if I don't do this now, I'm never going to go. So I wanted to go back to Japan to reclaim the past for myself, and also use that as a setting for a book that would be different than the other books in the series.
I've always thought it must be, you know, just incredible fun to be a fiction writer, to get to decide, oh, I want to set this book in, where have I not been? I've not been to Finland, so let me set this book. But it sounds to me like you get to do a little bit of that, but you're also using this as a way to deal with your past in a way. You're using the fact that you have to go in and do this research and do this work.
Well, yes and no. When it started with The Informationist, I was writing about Equatorial Guinea, which was a country off the coast of West Africa where I'd lived for a little over 2 years. And I wanted, at the time that I started writing The Informationist, I really didn't have a concept of fiction. I'd read very, very few novels in my life, and I didn't understand genre. So I just knew that when I read books, they were exciting. And that's because I'd been reading thrillers like Robert Ludlum's Jason Bourne series. And so I decided, well, you know, if I'm going to tell stories, I want to make them exciting. So that's how I fell into the thriller genre. And originally, I was writing about this place where I had lived. I wanted to bring it to life for readers who'd never been there. And it's just this paranoid, corrupt, backwater hellhole. At least it was at the time. I know it's changed a bit, but it still has a lot of those characteristics to it. So it was an opportunity to take readers through this place. That's what I was writing about. So when I wrote the second book, when the first book published, there was so much to-do made about my past. And a lot of people were conflating the character of Vanessa Michael Monroe with me. And I got so many questions about, well, what was it like for you growing up? What was it like for you growing up? So with the second book, which was The Innocent, I did the same thing that I'd done with The Informationist, was I took readers into a world that I'd lived in, and I wanted to show it to them in an exciting way. And that world in the second book, The Innocent, was the world of the cult that I was born and raised in. And I often did get this question of, was it cathartic for you to write that story? And it makes me laugh because no. It would have been impossible to have written that story if I hadn't already dealt with the past. Because if you're processing all the emotions, when you deal with the trauma of the things that happen to you, you feel rage and you feel anger and you feel helplessness and you feel sorrow, and there's all this emotion. And to be able to write dispassionately about a subject and just say, here, let me show you what it was like, you can't do that if you're processing through all the emotion at the same time. So the only way I would have been able to write that story if I'd already dealt with it, and it was long in the past. But it was an opportunity to show readers an inside look at an environment that mostly they only see from sensationalist point of view from the media, or there are other stories that are cult related, but they're not by people who lived in the cult. And so usually they're straw men, and bad guys are made to be really bad. And mm-hmm. I didn't want to do that. And I showed a world where it's not always black and white. And you know, we can hate on these people, but they're still human type thing.
Yes, go ahead.
That one was a little bit more related to my past, but it wasn't like I was using it as a way to deal with my past. Whereas in this fifth book, The Mask, I've had already dealt with the past, but I had never gone back and revisited those streets where I'd been out there as a child and as a teenager, asking people for money and tromping through the cold from door to door and shop to shop, trying to get people to buy trinkets, and just that depth of poverty and never having enough and not really belonging to anyone because I didn't have anyone looking out for me. I wanted to go back and reclaim that and rewrite it from a place of triumph. So in that sense, it wasn't so much that I was utilizing that to put the material in the book. I needed to go there to research the location for the book, but simultaneously I was coming back as a conqueror. So it's hard to explain.
Well, you do really get a sense of the location in your books. I mean, in The Catch, it was the Kenyon Street life, I think, that was really vibrantly portrayed. And now in The Mask, where we go inside the hostess clubs, we see the streets, and I think it's Osaka, right? You were in Osaka?
Yes, mostly Osaka.
So what's your process like? I mean, how do you get, what's the secret to getting an authentic feel for a place?
I think it's been a little different for every single book that I've worked on. I come to writing and storytelling from a very different place than most writers, because I do it all by gut instinct. And when I'm writing about a place, I do describe what I see, but I tend more to discuss what I feel. And I described this once before when trying to explain to somebody, and I think it's still the best example I have, is that many writers, if they were to walk into a cathedral, they would describe the statues and the way the light comes through the stained glass windows, and maybe that it was how old the stones were, and, you know, a history of the cathedral. When I put a character into that cathedral, I describe the cold and the smell and the memories that it brings back. And so that's what gives readers a chance to feel that sense of place rather than just have it told to them.
Talking with Taylor Stevens, author of the best-selling Vanessa Michael Munro series of books. Her latest novel is The Mask. You can join our conversation. 800-933-5372 is the phone number. You can email us, think@kera.org, or you can send me a tweet. I'm at Jeff Whittington on Twitter. Stay with us. We'll be back in about 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, a customizable evening master's degree for working professionals. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA in Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton. I'm Jeff Whittington, in today for Chris Boyd. We're talking with Taylor Stevens, author of the best-selling Vanessa Michael Munro series of books. Her latest novel is called The Mask. And you can join us at 800-933-5372. You can email us at think@kera.org or send me a tweet. I'm at Jeff Whittington on Twitter. Taylor Stevens, you grew up in this group called the Children of God. For those that aren't familiar with them, describe what the organization was all about.
Well, it was an apocalyptic movement that believed that the world was ending, well, any day, basically. Started in the late 1960s in Southern California, and because the leader believed that the United States was going to be destroyed, their members spread across the globe. So they became very international, and they were very nomadic. They didn't believe in owning property, and everything was communal. So nothing that a person had was really theirs, and that included children and spouses. Everything belonged to the group and to the commune that they were living in. So because the world was coming to an end any day, they didn't believe that education for their children was necessary. So anything beyond sixth grade was considered a waste of time. And there were a lot of us kids because they didn't believe in birth control either. So we were put to work, and we were the backbone, basically, of the movement. And, you know, our days revolved around cooking and cleaning, and since they didn't also believe in, you know, working in society because that was serving the devil, we would be out on the streets a lot, usually the children, begging for, you know, asking people for money, donations, and trying to sell things on behalf of the movement. So it was a very dreary existence, to say the least. We weren't allowed to read books or watch movies, with very rare exception, watch movies from the outside, listen to music, any of that. So we were very cloistered, very, very cloistered from outside.
When did you realize that at the very least your family wasn't like other families, and at the very worst that you were involved in essentially a cult?
Well, knowing that my family was different from other families was from very, very young. I can't remember back far enough that I didn't know that. But the awareness that of what you're involved in, that doesn't come until you're actually out and have a chance to really think for yourself and see examples of the way that other people live and how what you were grown up, raised, believing is not really how it was, whether it's a history lesson or geopolitical lesson or whatever it was, that the way you were taught things were is kind of flipped around from the way everybody else sees it. And you start to see how other families raise their children. And that's when it dawns on you of how messed up it was.
Were you able to hang out or interact with other kids when you were a kid in these various countries?
In the sporadic times that I went to public school, up until I think I left public school for good when I was 11, I had other friends, but it wasn't like I ever really hung out at their house or they ever came over to ours. It was just I saw them during the school day. And since for me to be able to access books was such a rare treat, I spent most of my time in school that I wasn't in class in school libraries just reading. So I didn't even really have a lot of friends when I was in school.
How did your parents explain what was going on?
Well, they didn't have to, because it just was.
It's just the way you were.
It's kind of like, this is the culture that you live in. It's like, how does a Japanese parent explain to their children what it means to be Japanese? It's just, you just learn, you're just in it. And so it is a culture, and that is the society that you were raised in. So it's just all that you know.
And when you were 12 years old, I gather you were separated from your parents.
Yeah, so we had just moved to Japan. And the cult had gone through many iterations throughout the years. And there would be times when everybody lived in communes. And then there would be times when everybody was scattered and living quasi-independently. And when we went to Japan, we got there right on the edge of another huge shift in the way that the cult was operating, and they were going, drawing tighter again into communes. And I'm one of the oldest that was born into that movement. There are not a lot. At the time, there were maybe hundreds of cult members in Japan at the time, but maybe only 10 teenagers.
Wow.
So they grouped them all together in one place, which as a 12-year-old, you're thinking, oh, cool, there's friends that I can actually hang out with instead of a bunch of dumb kids. But, you know, you're not looking at it like I can look back at it now as an adult and as a parent at the perspective of, oh, that is a bad idea to take 12-year-old and just throw them into a commune of 100 people with nobody specifically looking out for them. But, you know, when you get to hang out with friends for a few hours a day, you kind of are willing to overlook all the other stuff and the hours and hours and hours of quote unquote slave labor. It's like, but I get to be with friends. So it was it's a dichotomous type situation at that age when you're experiencing it.
And you started actually writing some stories around this time.
When I was, I guess, 13, 14, I sort of became the de facto entertainment for a lot of the younger kids, because when we'd go out begging, soliciting, we wouldn't go to the same places over and over because, you know, it's pretty obvious when you have a bunch of little white kids out on the street. So we'd spend a lot of time in the back of vans being transported from place to place to place, just brain-numbingly boring. And so I would make up stories, and I was the entertainment. And then I guess when I was around 14 or so, I started writing them down. And they were, come up with some notebooks, and I'd write so small in them because notebooks were hard to come by. And I'd pass them around to my peers, and, you know, I didn't realize I was doing anything wrong. But when I was 15, the leadership found out about them, and oh my God, the world ended. And so they took them away from me, and they burned them. They had exorcisms over me and kept me away from all my peers, lest I contaminate with them with the devils that caused me to act out. So that was sort of the end of my fiction writing career as a teenager. And then years later, when I was out and, you know, I had discovered fiction as an adult, that was part of the impetus of when I had that aha moment that I wanted to write fiction. It was like, well, they never let me write, and I always wanted to write, so I'm going to write a book. And that's kind of how I got started.
Well, is there any relationship between what you started writing later on that turned into this series work that you were doing back then?
No. I mean, as a kid, I was writing, you know, how much does a kid who's cloistered away from the world really know about anything? So it's just writing kid stories.
Well, it sounds like it was pretty exciting. If you know, I can see you with all the kids gathered around and you're telling the stories. It sounds like they might have been pretty exciting.
They were for us as kids. Anyway.
Well, what's the first book that you remember reading?
Well, I know when I was 9 or 10, I had the Chronicles of Narnia series. We were allowed to have those for a time. I think, well, really the first books that I remember reading, this is kind of funny, I totally didn't even think about this until you asked the question, but the cult was really big on early childhood education. They didn't let us have an education beyond 12, but, you know, we were all reading from age 2 and 3. And so the books that they used to teach us to read, they were called Peter and Jane readers. I think they came out of Britain. They were the Ladybird books. Mm-hmm. And so those were the books that I would read reading primers for enjoyment to read them. And, you know, once I finally got into school, then, of course, there were library books and stuff. But so I went through a lot of the Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boy, Trixie Belden books, anything I could get my hands on, which wasn't much, but other than that, I don't really recall.
Now, you mentioned the Robert Ludlum books, and I take it you were reading those later on in life, and they kind of gave you this inspiration. Talk a little bit about when Monroe first appeared in your mind's eye, when you first started thinking of this character.
Well, like you said, years later, so I, you know, me and my ex-husband, we were still married at the time and settled in Dallas. And, you know, we didn't know, we had entered the real world with no education, no job history, no social structure, just nothing that people raised in first world countries typically take for granted when they head out on their own. And so, you know, it was really, really hard in so many ways, not just financially, but just trying to figure life out. And so I would go to garage sales on the weekends to find things that I could resell on eBay and kind of supplement our income. And that's how I discovered fiction, because books are really cheap at garage sales. And I discovered Robert Ludlum and Jason Bourne. And I was reading one of the Jason Bourne books when I had that aha moment. But I didn't like have a character or anything in mind when I started writing, when I was like, oh, I'm going to write this book about Equatorial Guinea. I just had this place that I wanted to write in. So the character came very slowly, and I was heavily influenced by Jason Bourne, of course, because I loved that just tormented aspect of his character, and I loved that he was so capable, that he was so dangerous, not just to others, but to himself. And you can definitely see that elements of that have found their way into Vanessa Michael Monroe. And at right around that same time, I saw both of the Lara Croft movies. And Lara Croft, she's a bit of a caricature. I mean, there's not a real lot of depth to her. But I loved that she was so sensually a woman who could kick butt. And I was drawn to that part of her character as well. So that sort of found her way there. Its way into Monroe too. And it's interesting because as a character, I learned more about Monroe after The Informationist was published from reading readers' responses to her than I had in actually creating the character.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about some of the techniques that Monroe uses, because you're an expert in espionage, fieldcraft, martial arts, all the stuff that she makes. She makes it look and sound so easy, but, you know, real specific things like where to grab somebody to disable them and how, you know, specifically she rolls through in a fight. You know, how did you master all that?
Well, I haven't mastered it. I've just faked it really good.
So you're not working out every weekend in a dojo somewhere?
There's two issues at play. One is having taught myself everything that I know how to find what I need to know to make sure that at least I'm not writing something stupid or miss, you know. As an example, you'll never get any heavier criticism as a thriller writer than if you say something wrong about a gun. Right. The gun lovers will come from everywhere to tell you how wrong you are
about
the gun.
Journalists hear that same criticism, by the way.
So what I've learned how to do as an author is learn just enough about something that I'm not writing the wrong thing and getting tons and tons of criticism. The other thing, too, is I've learned that less is more, and the less accurately play-by-play I describe something, the more the reader's able to fill those blanks in, and it's so vivid inside their mind, and they don't realize that it's their imagination that's doing it. I'm just giving them the structure to do it in. So it sounds like I really, really, really know what I'm talking about, but actually the reader is bringing their own experience to the page.
Hmm. So, yeah, I'm really always fascinated by the idea that you learn more about the character. And obviously, you're the creator of the character, and you write the novels. But from book to book, as the character grows, it's kind of a give and take. I mean, I wonder when you wake up in the morning, if your first thought is your thought, or if your first thought is Monroe's thought.
No, the first thought is definitely my thought. Oh, I'm tired. I don't want to get out of bed. Monroe is fiction, and the only time that I'm really inside her head is when I'm writing or I'm thinking about writing. There's no confusion in my mind over what is what.
Well, I want to talk a little bit about your work, the process that you go through as a writer. And you decided just to write the first book. And I wonder if you can tell us about the day you knew that it was going to work out, that this was going to be a career for you.
I guess that would have been the day that it published. I didn't know, you know. a lot of authors, when they start off on this journey, they already have a concept, some structural concept of publishing or of writing or what books are out there, authors that they love, just something, you know, they've read book reviews. I didn't have any of that. And so even when I had finished the book, the first book, and people told me, this is really good, I still didn't know that it had anything to it. And then I had an agent. And there, you know, we don't have enough time to go into all that backstory. Mm-hmm. But even when the agent said, this is really good, I didn't know because, you know, they can't promise that they're going to sell it. They can only try. And then when it did get sold, it was one more confirmation like, hey, we might have something here. But I didn't know until that book actually got published and people were buying it. And then I started hearing from readers who had fallen in love with it. And they were like, this is so awesome. Then I was like, oh, okay. Well, I guess this is what I'm going to do now. I get to be a writer.
And your initial deal was a multi-book deal. So obviously you
were planning
on it. It was a two-book deal.
Mm-hmm. And I didn't even know if I had it in me to write the second book. I was terrified. I didn't know if I could. The first one, it just sort of happened organically. Didn't know what I was doing. I had to teach myself how to write. I mean, not how to write. I was literate, but I had to teach myself how to write fiction, which is very, very different. And it was a learning process, trial and error and, you know, just figuring it all out. And so when it came to write that second one, I was terrified because I didn't know if I could do it. And then after I had that second one done, I was like, okay, I sort of am starting to get the hang of this now. But even still, anytime I start a book, it's a little bit scary. Can I do it again? You know, are people going to... I always have that fear that this book is going to be released and it's going to be awful and everyone's going to hate it and that's going to be the end of it.
Well, I want to talk more about your process when we come back from a quick break. I'm talking this hour with Taylor Stevens. She's the author of the best-selling Vanessa Michael Monroe series of books. Actually lives here in Dallas, Texas as well. And we'll talk a little bit about the Dallas literature scene when we come back. You can join us calling 800-933-5372. You can email us think@kera.org or send me a tweet. I'm at Jeff Whittington on Twitter. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program. You can apply now for fall and design your own master's degree at SMU, specializing in communications or organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA in Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton. I'm Jeff Whittington in today for Chris Boyd. We're talking with Taylor Stevens, whose latest novel is The Mask. It's the fifth novel, and there's also a novella in there in the Vanessa Michael Monroe series of best-selling action thrillers. You can call if you have a question for Taylor Stevens, 800-933-5372. You can email us think@kera.org or send me a tweet. I'm at Jeff Whittington on Twitter. Now, Taylor, we're talking to you today from NPR Studios in New York City because the book just came out. You're on a book tour, but you live and work in Dallas. Talk a little bit about the Dallas literature scene, and you know, it's kind of started to percolate a little bit.
I'm the worst person to ask about any of that. I'm a hermit. I live in my house. I work long hours at my desk, and I'm very still non-cultured. So,
well, does it matter where you are, or can you just get the work done? No matter where you are, is writing in Dallas no different for you than writing in New York?
As long as I'm not traveling, it's hard to do that kind of work when, you know, you're juggling flights and meetings and all of that. But if I was to just be sitting in a hotel room for a week, I would get the same, probably more work done than sitting at home. So it is pretty location neutral.
Well, talk about your process a little bit. I mean, you had the first book, you wrote the book, then you sold the book, but then the second book came with a deadline, I would imagine.
Yes.
And I wonder how you manage that kind of pressure. Is it, you know, do you have a routine you go through every day? What's your process like?
Well, first, I just want to put this out there that for anybody who's listening and who's interested in more in-depth than what we can cover today, I email very regularly about everything that I've learned in this journey along the way. And because I had to self-teach, I approach it from a little bit of a different perspective than others. And you can get that on my website at taylorstevensbooks.com. And there's a Connect With Me button, and it'll get you hooked up. And so, because there's only so much that we can cover this time.
You're known for responding to people when they reach out to you.
I try really hard. Yeah, I try. I adore my readers and my fans. They're who keep me in business. And I don't have any lofty aspirations. I'm a storyteller. I'm an entertainer. And my readers are the world to me. So I do have a very active exchange going on through email with those who do contact me. But as far as that second book and the process that went to it, oh, I was so scared. And it was a funny thing because my agent had explained to me that the way it works with the first book is that, of course, you have to write the whole book. But with the second one, the publisher is typically going to want to see an outline and then maybe the first three or four chapters. And I had never outlined before. And having never gone to school and learned really basic things like that, I was terrified by the thought of it. And I thought, you know what? And I think I might have even said this to her, why don't I just write the whole book? That would be easier than doing an outline and a few chapters, because I just didn't know how to do it. Now I outline extensively because I find that through outlining, I can fix the story problems in advance and not be, you know, 50,000 words into a story and then find out that, oops, that doesn't actually work, and then have to go back and delete it all. Because when you're on a deadline, you don't have that kind of time. And so the second book was written very quickly because I was so freaked out that I couldn't do the deadline that I just burned through it. But I was also writing material that did not require a lot of research because I was writing a world that I knew,
sure,
unfortunately, too well.
This is the book. This is the book where the child, where Monroe goes to rescue a child who has been taken into a cult. Right.
That's right. So my process has been ever evolving as I learn more about the craft and time management and just dealing with expectations. I've had more of a routine. I do a lot more thinking and plotting and planning on paper before I actually start writing the story now, whereas with the Informationist, I didn't know what I was doing. I just wrote it. And it's funny to me, sometimes I'll hear people say, oh, I knew who the bad guy was halfway through the book. And I was like, that's awesome, because I didn't. I didn't figure it out till the end. But I think the outlining now has made my plots a little bit stronger.
Are there other things that you'd like to write? Is this your genre?
Well, you know, it is a tricky thing, because when you write in a specific genre, that's what people expect to read from you. And if I were to write something else, there's a possibility that my thriller fans would absolutely hate it because this is what they want to read. So there's this cliche that, you know, writers have more ideas than they have time to write them. And I definitely, you know, meet that. So this is what I do for a living. And so whatever my personal desires might be, you know, I'd like to write this other story, have this other idea, whatever. If it doesn't fall in line with what my readers expect from me, then it's just going to have to wait, because this is my job. And to do my job well, I have to entertain my audience the way they want to be entertained. So until I can figure out how to clone myself and write two or three books a year, we're kind of in the thriller genre.
Well, the books kind of occasionally end with Monroe sort of riding off into the sunset. And I'm always left thinking, is this it? And I wonder if you...
That's because I never know either. And so you don't want to leave a book with a cliffhanger that readers are expecting that the next one's going to be right around the corner, when maybe you're not going to get to it for a couple of years. So,
well, and you're sort of in this situation where you kind of have to schedule creativity as well, because you know, is that what it feels like to you? Or are you still able to kind of feel like this is really something that's coming in a way that is a creative process for you?
Well, you know, that's a really, really interesting question, because I do not consider myself a creative. I am more of an analyst in my mind. I'm happy bean counting and working with spreadsheets. And creative work is really, really hard for me. And I wrote a piece about that once, about writer's block, because for me, writer's block is my perpetual state. I have never had any other way of writing than to deal with it every single day. Like this concept that you can write from inspiration, or that things just come to you, or that the characters tell you and you just listen and transcribe. Oh my God, I hate those writers. I want to be like that, and I don't have that. So it's work. It is work. It is not work that I begrudge or that I complain about. I don't mean it like that. It's just, it's not easy. And so I very much treat it as, this is my job. This is what I do. This is how I pay the bills. I don't have a plan B.
Yeah, I read somewhere you said that you were sometimes enjoyed just doing your taxes.
Yes, that's relaxing for me. not on the years where I don't have money to pay for them, but yeah, it is easier for me to do that than it is to have to conjure up these worlds from scratch. The first drafts are always the hardest for me, because that's where those bones get sketched out.
Now, what can you tell us about the movie version of the first book?
That maybe it might get made. Uh-huh. I mean, James Cameron of Titanic and Avatar fame has the option, film right. option rights to it, but he's very tied up with making some big movies right now. So, you know, it's going to be a long time if he ever does get around to it, and I really have my fingers crossed. I would love to see this book, this series made as a movie. I know that he really loves the character. He gets her. He will do right by her no matter what he does if he gets this made into a movie. But it's going to be a long, long wait before it happens.
What was that phone call like when you found out that Cameron was picking up the option?
There had been some other things bouncing around at the time. And so when my film agent, he contacted me and said, hey, we've had some interest in The Informationist. I'd like to give you a call. I said, sure, because, you know, I'm thinking, whatever, it's stuff. And he gets on the phone and he says, so I just got off the phone with James Cameron's people, and they want The Informationist. And I kind of had this pause, because I'm not real pop culture referencey, you know, like I've missed so much of that stuff. And I thought, I'm not sure. So I said to him, I said, I'm not sure that I heard you right. Do you mean like James Cameron, Titanic James Cameron? And he's like, yeah, James Cameron. And I just started laughing. I thought it was the most hilarious thing. I said, okay, I'm not getting this. This is not sinking in, but keep talking. That was how I got the news. It was awesome.
Have you sat down with him? Have you talked about this?
I did. I had a chance to meet him. Him and his producing partner, John Landau. It was a lovely meeting and an opportunity to discuss the characters and the settings. And just that I found out that they're both real big fans of the series. They have all the books. They've read all the books. And it was really quite spectacular. It was a very big fangirl moment for me. To geek out, and it seemed very surreal at the time, and I'm like, I have pictures to prove it. I'll look back on them one day.
So you're a self-described hermit. You keep your schedule, and you like to count things, and you have you struggle with writer's block. But you're in New York, I take it, for a conference, and
it's Thriller Fest week.
Yeah, and I assume you're going to get up on stage in front of a bunch of people. What?
Not this time around. No, I have done that before. I enjoy public speaking. I have a much easier time. It's bizarre. I have a much easier time getting up in front of a crowd of 200 or 300 people than sitting one-on-one with 2 or 3 of my readers. Because when you're speaking to a crowd, you just say what you're there to say, and that's that. But when you're in that close personal environment, I have this pressure of, if they get to know the real me, they're going to be so disappointed. And so I'm just like, I don't want to disappoint them. I want to give them whatever they came here to see me, you know. So it's just it's bizarre. But this time around, I'm not on stage.
So what is your week like in New York then? If you're not going to speak, is it meetings or conferences?
A lot of meetings, yes, a lot of meetings. And this is really when authors come to these types of events, I found that it's more about a chance to just network and meet with readers and hang out. And honestly, almost everything just happens at the bar at night.
Of course.
So as long as you're there at the bar, you're where it's happening.
So if we have a couple of minutes left, and you know the Vanessa Michael Monroe and Taylor Stevens fans who are listening would take me to task if I didn't ask what you can tell us about what might be coming up next for Monroe.
Well, I can't because I don't know. So it's just one of those secrets. Yeah.
So do you have a list of places that you're interested in? And examining or interested in visiting or interested in?
I think that I don't actually have a list of places, but I know that the next story would probably take us back to Europe, more on the eastern side of Europe. And it wouldn't be as culturally in-depth as many of the other stories were. A bit more like the third book in the series, The Doll, which is a journey from place to place to place, and they never really stayed long enough because it dealt with human trafficking. Mm-hmm. This one wouldn't deal with human trafficking, but it would be on the move a lot.
And if I didn't give you a chance to talk a little bit about the team that you work with, I think that wouldn't be fair either. And in your acknowledgments, you credit a couple of friends who've lived a long time in Japan and who kind of gave you some insight to the culture. Do you have folks like that all around the world that you can go to fact check and see if you're getting the feel of a place?
There aren't a lot of benefits to being raised in a religious cult that was nomadic and international, but that would be one, is that I know people all over the world.
Well, Taylor Stevens is the author of the best-selling Vanessa Michael Monroe series of books. Her latest novel is The Mask. Taylor Stevens, thank you so much for spending this time with us and talking about your past and your work. We really, really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been so fun.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker, engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is our associate producer. You can find me on Twitter. I'm at Jeff Whittington. And of course, you can contact us via email at think@kera.org. Stay with us. In the next hour, we're going to talk about pollinators in peril. We're going to spend the hour talking with a panel of experts on bees. So stick with us. But once again, I'm Jeff Whittington. Thanks very much for listening. Have a great day. Yeah.